fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPU 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and we've got Mr. David Martino.
I'm here. Somewhere.
Yeah,
I'm hiding.
You're somewhere. You're hiding.
I'm hiding in the House of Mystery in the basement.
Yeah,
that's where you've locked me.
Good place for you. We don't want you out in the public.
That's right.
Causes nothing but trouble. Okay, so let's see. We're going to get right into it today on this show, and we've got, let's see, an author with us, done a true crime story, followed a murder case, and it's the Berman Murders, Unraveling the Mojave Desert's Most Mysterious Unsolved Crime. So we've got the author, Doug Carey. So thank you for being here, Doug.
Thank you, Alan, and thank you, David. It's a pleasure.
Well, we'll see how it is at the end of the show. See if he's still a pleasure. Listen, this is quite a case, and I slightly remember it. I mean, because this is from back in, you know, 86. So what drew you to this case enough that you decided to research it and write a book?
Alan, it was the location. I'd been going there since college, and this is not just an ordinary location where these murders took place. It's an isolated desert valley, an absolutely gorgeous, pristine spot, about as isolated as anything in the western United States. And in the middle of this valley is an oasis of hot springs that have been developed into kind of a counterculture mecca. And people know about it just by word of mouth, and they will travel this horrendous 50-mile dirt road route to get in there and make camp. And when you arrive there, it's like no other place I've ever been. I mean, imagine pulling in and you just see people that are casually walking around, maybe with a big broad-brimmed hat, sunglasses, and a pair of sandals and nothing else. And everybody's communing with nature. It's a very freewheeling kind of an environment, yet very sensitive in that kind of counterculture hippie way. And I'd been going there for years and exploring the surrounding mountains just into the desert. And that's how I first heard about the case. It's like, wow, in this magical spot, these murders had occurred. And people just couldn't believe it.
Now, it says in the when you do research on this that the Mojave Desert draws, you know, nudists and eccentrics. So you were a nudist eccentric. That's why you were going there.
All of the above. I mean, listen, if you're going to really explore the desert, which I've been doing as since I was a kid, I mean, you kind of have to be cool with whatever environment you're in, whether it's miners that are operating a mining claim or it's a hippie gathering place or whatever. And that's one of the great things about the desert environments is that they challenge your boundaries a little bit. And I was okay with it.
So is it really like it says then? Is there, how many people are hang out there? Is it like was it a touristy sort of place, or was it, like you said, it was just off the beaten path? So was there big crowds there or just a few people?
Well, a big crowd out there, Alan, would probably nowadays, maybe at the peak time of year, you might have 100 people camping at these various, hot springs that are spread over an area of about a square mile. There's various developed tubs where the water has been piped into stone and cement baths where people soak and a lot of times they're drinking or passing joints or just chatting, taking photos of the surroundings, the wilderness, that kind of thing. And I've been there when I'm the only one, and I've been there when it's relatively crowded. But it's not an easy place to find. It's not signed. And so, although I don't carry a map anymore when I go out there, one of the more recent times I went out there, I just missed the turnoff. It's one of those things where you're out on dirt roads and you see these wheel tracks. It's like, wait a minute, was I supposed to turn there? And so it is rather isolated. It's hard to get to. I mean, right now with the rains we've had in California, I don't even know if you can get in there. I haven't heard word about whether the two primary access roads are passable.
So what's the purpose for a lot of people going there before we get into the story here? So why would people go there? It's just a hangout. Is that it? Is there any other reason? Go sit in the springs?
I think a hangout sells it a little short of what it's become. It's almost like being on another planet. Seriously, you get out there into this desert valley where the silence is absolutely palpable. The landscape is extreme. You're surrounded by steep mountain ranges. And then it's at once an inhospitable place, and yet it has this wonderful feeling of being somewhere where you've never been in the middle of this natural environment. And when you get to the oasis, it's almost like being on a ship at sea. You naturally strike up conversations and bond with other people because you're in this extraordinary spot surrounded by inhospitable desert with incomparable views, and then this wonderful mineral water to soak in. And it's just a welcoming vibe. And for a lot of people, they find themselves coming back, you know, month after month, year after year. Out there, they're called saliners. It's Saline Valley. They're called saliners or regulars. Now, I was never a regular because I was too restless to just hang out. I wanted to go explore the mountains and do other things. I was as into the mountain ranges that surround the valley as I was into the valley and the scene itself. But I've spent plenty of time in those baths and soaking and just taking in the views and talking with people. You'll meet people from all over the world out there. But again, it's word of mouth.
Do you think this couple was a regular? Were there regulars that knew each other? Is there a sense of community, or is it completely, you just go there and people are in the right frame of mind so you can hang out in the bath and talk? What do you think?
So down at the what's called the lower Warm Springs, which as you come in from the main dirt road is the first place you get, that is more developed. There's an outdoor library. There's an irrigated lawn. There's multiple bathing pools. And it's a scene. People know each other. The regulars tend to go there. Somebody might be playing a guitar or whatever. And that is more of a social scene. If you go to where the Burmans camp, which is about 3/4 of a mile up a road, it's a little more undeveloped. And out there, it's not a place people tend to know each other. They just meet when they're out there. And it's a little more of a back to nature spot. And for the Burmans, it was their first time ever going.
So the first time they went is when they went missing? Like, it was the very first time?
It is. They arrived on a Sunday evening. It was a beautiful night, no moon, lots of stars. They bathed in a tub with three strangers, three men. The next morning, they got up very early and took a walk up a rugged jeep trail that leads in the direction of some undeveloped springs a couple of miles away, and they never came back. And then almost 3 years later, their bodies turned up miles away in a shallow grave, a cut bank. If you know what a cut bank is, where periodic flash flooding has carved a dry river course through the desert wilderness. And in one of these troughs, kind of imagine a riverbed with all the water gone. It's dry and it's not even. Over on the side, there's kind of a trough that's been cut in one wall. And down in that trough, their bodies had been stacked atop each other.
Wow. Was there ever an expectation that Saline Valley, in any of those areas, was there ever an expectation that it was a dangerous place?
There is some expectation, David, that it's a dangerous place in the sense that if you get off off route, if you get lost out there, or if you're underprepared, or you come the wrong time of year, and you don't know what you're doing, and you make a mistake, you can pay for that mistake with your life. It has happened. There was a case several decades ago, it was before the Burmans disappeared, where a father and his son and another guy went out there just to explore old mines. And they were out there in the heat of summer, and their vehicle slipped into a rut, and they got stuck. And they had this terrible idea, well, why don't we just walk for help? Well, their bodies ended up being found one after another, strung out along the road as they died.
So when these when this couple disappeared originally, is that kind of what the thought was, that they kind of got lost somewhere probably?
That was the original thought, was that they got lost somewhere. But then there was this massive search and rescue effort. It was, I believe, the largest search and rescue effort that had ever been mounted in Inyo County, California. There were assets that were coming in from the Army, from the Navy. It was really a huge effort involving helicopters, ground teams, fixed-wing aircraft. And not a trace, not a trace. And given that there were two of them, it just seemed unlikely that they had gotten into trouble and you couldn't spot their bodies. The idea that there may have been some foul play started to gather steam as the search went on and nothing turned up.
Wow. So how long did the search last? And then did they just, and they called it quits? They obviously didn't find the bodies in the original search then.
They did not. The search lasted 10 full days, and then there were subsequent searches. They came back again. The search and Inyo County Search and Rescue came back and did another push, and also there was a private search effort. Barry Berman's father was an extraordinarily wealthy man. He made his fortune in the liquor trade. He was a promoter of overseas brands at a time when overseas brands weren't common in the United States. And he had this idea that as tastes evolve, people would be interested in having overseas alcoholic beverages among their repertoire of choices. And his first engagement in that regard was with a kind of an obscure, interesting tasting beer called Heineken. And he was instrumental in bringing that, promoting that in the United States. And obviously it was just this huge success. And then he got involved with J&B Scotch, Bass Pale Ale, and others. And then he ended up purchasing the Kahlua brand when it was obscure. He put all this money into marketing. He was really a genius promoter. This was Jules Berman, Barry Berman's father, and just became, you know, fabulously wealthy. And then he got into oil and real estate. And when his only son, only child, went missing, he chartered an airplane, flew up to Inyo County, offered a $25,000 reward. They brought in a psychic. He did everything that he could think of to try to find his son. And there was just no trace.
So was there any reason for them to be suspicious of some sort of murder, like when they were up there, when the Bermans went up there and they were just there a day and hung out and then went missing? What was the thought after a couple of years? Like, did they have enemies or something?
Well, that was something that investigators looked at, because here you've got two peaceful people, and you have to understand something about Barry Berman's background. Unlike his father, he was not taken by mega deals and wealth. He rejected his father's lifestyle. He was the quintessential poor little rich boy who felt neglected by his parents. He was very a very cerebral kind of a guy. He was growing up in the 1960s. He started experimenting with smoking weed, taking LSD, and getting into the mind, and he wanted something different. Eventually, after graduation from high school, Barry did a journey across the world that led him to northern India, to Punjab province, and he became a disciple of a Punjabi guru named Charan Singh, who had millions of followers worldwide. And when he came back to the United States, to Southern California, he got involved in that faith. And so he was a very meditative, peace-loving person. He believed in karma, and he believed the killing of meat, the slaying of animals for meat, would bring bad karma. And so he was a vegetarian, and he and his older wife were very kind of mellow, hippie people who really, you know, walked their talk in terms of living a simple lifestyle. So it didn't seem plausible that he would have any enemies. So they were considering all these theories, everything from, well, was he abducted? Were they abducted? To, was it a UFO abduction?
Well, of course. What else would it be? You know, it happens to me all the time, right? I'm always getting abducted and probed. So this, they don't find the body. Their searches kind of fade away. And then 3 years later, someone finds the body by accident. So the bodies. So what happened then? Like how did they die?
We don't know. What was concluded by the authorities was that it was a homicide. All of the circumstances that surrounded their disappearance clearly pointed at homicide. When the hiker who found their remains in a very remote corner of Saline Valley first stumbled across a skull, and then the authorities came back and surveyed the site, found the bones, excavated the grave, it was apparent that they had been methodically concealed. Their clothing, most of their clothing was missing. A handcuff key was located, and it became apparent that this was a methodical burial, which would indicate a homicide. However, the manner in which they died was never determined. Now, in the book, I did uncover information from prison informants that suggests at a methodology of death, but it's not conclusive. There's no physical evidence. There was no physical evidence found to indicate cause of death.
So what happened in the eyes of law enforcement then? Did they follow up on the case, or did it just sort of fade away?
Yeah, good question, and a little bit of both. There was one very dogged deputy. He was not formally assigned to the case as an investigator, a guy named Leon Boyer, a rancher by background, and just the quintessential rancher type guy, kind of a big guy with pale blue eyes and big hands, slow talking, but had this ability to think like a deviant. And he was sure that he knew which of the limited number of people was at the scene when they disappeared, did it. And he just needed to find this guy. And ultimately, he was able to track down a suspect. The suspect was questioned, and his answers were all over the board. And I was able to obtain case files, including a transcription of the interview. And the guy goes one place, and then he goes another. He kind of is trying to feel his way to whatever is going to give him the most wiggle room. It's quite a remarkable interview, and as you know, not something that's common in a murder investigation. Most people would lawyer up right away, but he didn't. And therefore, his answers are quite incriminating. But again, at the time he was interviewed, they didn't even have bodies. They had located the guy finally. It took him almost a year, and they interviewed him. But they didn't have bodies, didn't know if there had been a foul play or some other explanation.
Well, it's an interesting case. So years go by, and how did you get involved in it, in the sense of, yeah, you used to go there and you know the area and all that, but you didn't know the Burmans themselves, right? So what drew you into following up on the case?
Yeah, I had no personal connection to the case, didn't know any of the people involved, but it gnawed at me. I was starting to do law and crime-related writing, and I thought about the case one day. I don't want to sound too touchy-feely, but I was sitting at my desk, and a bird landed on the screen or a door right by my desk. I mean, it was weird. It landed kind of sideways. It was like it was looking in at me. And at that moment, I thought about the case. And coincidence, call it what you will, but that's how it happened. A bird landed there. I looked over and I thought about the Berman case. I hadn't thought about it in years. And I thought, I wonder what happened to those people out in the desert. I mean, it had gnawed at me, but in that particular moment, I wasn't thinking about it until this little bird somehow jolted my imagination. And I called up a buddy of mine that I've done a lot of desert mountaineering with, a really kind of a crazy guy, a former Marine, this huge muscle-bound guy, and can quote Shakespeare and the Bible and Arthur Miller. He's really an extraordinary guy, just off the charts in terms of being a unique character. And he has a tremendous memory. And he was also somebody who went up to Saline Valley a lot. And I told him, I'd like to dig into this case. And he started remembering people who might have been involved, who I should call. And he gave me names. And then just one thing led to another. And then the sheriff's office agreed they would open up some of their case files for me. And I just started getting deeper and deeper. And it was a 9-year odyssey from inception until I finally had a finished manuscript that Roman and Littlefield said, yeah, we want your book.
Well, it's interesting. What did doing this case and writing the book do for you? How did it affect you or change you?
Well, it frustrated the hell out of me, I'll tell you. It was a hard project to work on. I almost gave up so many times. But luckily, somebody would give me a nudge or at the outset, within a year, I had a cover story about the case in LA Weekly, and that generated some tips. That's part of what we talk about in the books, and people came forward. But in terms of getting my arms around it and putting it into a book, it tormented me more than anything. But luckily, I stuck with it, and it finally came together and it gelled. But I worked really hard on it to try to get all the pieces put together and turn it into a complete portrayal of a theory of the case. Listen, nobody's ever been arrested or even charged, but there is a suspect that law enforcement has had their eyes on for years. And I came into it with an open mind thinking, they probably got it wrong. Maybe it's somebody else, but they were right. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence that points in that direction. And during the investigation, I was able to develop more. But again, there's never been a charging decision made. So the reader kind of has to look at it and decide for themselves. Do they think there's a case here? Do they think there's closure here?
Well, so the suspect, the person that they sort of had their eye on and sort of you sort of followed up with, did you ever get a chance to speak with him yourself?
Well, I wish he'd talked to me. I certainly tried. I've written him a number of letters. He is incarcerated, so that's I know where he is at any given time. And I've spoken with his lawyer and suggested, that maybe there would be a time when he would sit down with me, but nothing has happened to date. And I'm told by his sisters that it's unlikely he'll ever talk to me. If he does, it's unlikely that he'll talk about the case. Maybe someday he would consent to just getting together. I don't think he necessarily likes me a lot, but on the other hand, he might want a chance to just talk about who he is and try to offer his point of view. I certainly would have liked to get his point of view, but I wasn't able to.
Right. Well, what do we know about him, or what did you find out about him that anything that would relate to this case?
I know a lot about him, and I do, in the book, paint a picture of some possible personality traits and incidents from his life that might hint at the direction that this case went, these murders. But what I developed, and when I say I developed information, I mean, I was able to interview his father, two of his sisters, people who knew him, and I was able to develop that manner of information. I think the most compelling information was what he did later in life, which might unmask kind of who he really is inside and what he fantasizes about, what he's capable of doing, because later in life, he went to Asia and committed horrific crimes against young women. And I go into quite a bit of detail about that. I include a warning at the beginning of the book. This is heavy subject.
So he's not necessarily the best character, but how does it relate to this couple? But because wasn't she an older person? I don't mean like old, but wasn't she in her 50s or something at the time when she was murdered?
Louise was 52. Barry was 35, so she was 17 years older, but she'd always had a way with men. Louise was a woman who was very engaging. She could be flirty, and she just had a way with men. Barry was her fourth husband, and she was always attracted to men, and men were attracted to her. It's possible, and one of the things I talk about in the book, Alan, is you know what, it's very possible what happened in the context of bathing together in warm water under the stars. Maybe things got a little familiar, and maybe he saw more than there was in the interaction. We don't know for sure. We do know that he propositioned another couple. He floated the idea of a threesome with another couple on that trip in that camp. So it suggests a possible motive. Perhaps there was a sexual motivation of some kind.
Yeah, because did you come up with any other theory or any other motive or reason to kill them as a couple?
No. Everyone that on the law enforcement side that had a theory tied that theory to what they thought was a sexual motivation. And the prison informants who came forward also offered information that would tend to suggest that.
Are they informants of him? Like they have been in prison with him rather than other people or the couple or anything?
I got a cellie to talk.
Oh, well, there you go. We won't ask how you did that.
By being charming, of course, Alan.
Well, of course. You're just sitting in the hot steam baths with the, you know. It works for me all the time. But do you want to talk about the theory and what you thought he might have done, or do you want to leave that for the readers? Is that something?
Well, let's leave some of the details for the readers, but I do think that something happened, and I present a theory in the book about what could have happened, backed by information that came from informants and the learned theories of law enforcement. But one of the enigmas of this book and of this investigation is we will never know exactly what happens. Even if he talks, we will never know exactly what happens. But we can certainly arrive at some theories. After I began the investigation, my investigation, the Inyo County Sheriff's Office decided to take another look at the case. They assigned a veteran investigator who spent 2 years working up a homicide report, and he felt strongly that he had enough at that point for the DA to indict. The DA ultimately decided not to indict. He felt that there wasn't enough evidence to win the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And that was, you know, a somewhat controversial decision among friends and family of the Burmans. But I understand. I mean, don't hold it against me. I'm a lawyer by background. So I do understand that it's tough to prosecute a murder case based on circumstantial evidence when so many years have passed.
How do her family or his family, the couple that was murdered, how do they react to any of this stuff in your book and stuff like, or have you heard?
There's only one immediate family member surviving of the Burmans, and that's Louise Berman's eldest son, Michael Westerman, who from the beginning was a wholehearted supporter of the project. I don't know if I could have done it without his support. Certainly it would have been a lot more difficult. And he is just the most open, empathetic, and forthcoming individual that you'd ever meet. Just wanted the truth. And even though there were things about his mom's personal history that might be considered checkered, I don't consider them checkered. I don't consider multiple marriages or experimenting with drugs or what have you, or even the stint that she did in jail to represent a checkered past. I just look at it as she was a wild child. She was an adventurous woman. She came at life hard, you know, and grabbed onto it. And that meant some ups and downs. But she was also, by all accounts, just a remarkably charming woman who was a free thinker, who loved to engage with people, who was very giving. And she went through so many tragedies and ups and downs in her life, yet emerged somebody who had just this optimistic outlook about life. And it was wonderful for me that Michael was so giving in providing information about his mom, and also not wincing when I used some of those facts, because I wanted to have a complete and honest portrayal of her and not some clean scrubbed version of the victim. I don't believe in clean scrubbing anything. I think the truth should be told the way it is. And that is how you get a complete picture.
Did you find yourself, or maybe it happened organically, did you find yourself putting a subtext? Is there some sort of an underlying meaning that comes across in the story?
I found a subtext in it. Whether I imparted a subtext, you'd have to tell me. I will say this. For me, yes, there was something that underlay it. There was something beautiful about the way they lived their lives. And it was incongruous for me that this horrific crime happened in such a beautiful place. When I finally located their gravesite, which was not easy, it took me several trips into one of the remotest parts of Saline Valley in order to find the gravesite. When I finally did locate it, and definitively it matched the photos, there was even the cairn of rocks there. I actually got on my back and laid down in the grave because I wanted to try to feel the energy of what took place there. But I came out of it believing that their spirits were not extinguished by the horrific ending that was visited upon them by whomever did it, whether it was this predator or some other predator that I don't know where or how they could have arrived at the scene. But I think we know who did it. But again, it's never been proven in a court of law.
Probably never will be, right? I mean, it's not something that they won't have the resources or the money to spend on it at this point in life and at time. And I guess it's something we'll never have officially closure of this at this point.
We won't, but Michael did tell me that he feels a sense of closure. He was very thankful that I devoted a chunk of my life to this story because although there were a lot of tears shed and, in a way, wounds open, maybe they were wounds that had never fully healed. And I think for him and for others who supported me in the project, who really cared about it, I do think they felt in the end that they could wrap their arms around it and say, okay, we've now got what this is about, enough at least that we can understand it, put it behind us, and accept where we are on the long process for those folks. And if I could, you know, bring some measure of closure to them, that's great. My goal was to really just play it out wherever it went. And I didn't know it would lead into some of the areas that it did. If I had no idea at the beginning of this, that this place out in the middle of nowhere was going to lead me, to crimes that were committed across the other side of the world.
So with the person that you suspect of this, what did you find out about him that was ties you to thinking he might have something to do with this case?
Well, suppose you'd reached a point in life where you were retired with a pension, like he was, retired from the Marine Corps with a pension. He'd been an officer, and essentially the slate wiped clean in your life. You've had some troubled marriages, but those are gone and behind you. Your kids are grown enough that they're on their own. And now you have the means to be able to travel to the other side of the world, rent a villa in Cambodia. You end up befriending some elites, including the former Cambodian prime minister. You meet the king and have your photo taken meeting the king. You're kind of arrived. You're operating at a high level in this society. What would you do with your money, your connections, and this villa that you have? What choice would you make, and what would that reveal about your underlying character? It's my premise, Alan, that if your choice is that you would use that as a foundation to build a life that centers around the imprisoning and trafficking of young women and raping, torturing, leaving them bleeding kind of existence, that probably didn't just emerge in midlife, that those urges were probably there. And I think there's scientific research that backs that as well. So my feeling was that he tipped his cards at that point in his life. And I explain that theory in the book, The Burning Murders.
Yeah, it's quite a story here. So where do you go from here? What's going to happen for Doug Carey now?
Well, yeah, I appreciate the teeing that up. I am deep into the Naomi Urion case. That was a more recent, high-profile case. We know exactly who did it and what happened. Up in northern Nevada, an 18-year-old girl parked in a Walmart parking lot. It was 5 in the morning. It was still dark outside, and she was waiting to catch a shuttle bus to the Tesla Gigafactory outside of Reno. She worked for Panasonic, that factory that Elon Musk spearheaded is a joint venture with Panasonic. And as she was waiting in her car, a 41-year-old construction supervisor forced his way into the car, took her out into the desert to a pre-dug grave, raped her, shot her in the back of the head, buried her, and then came back driving his fancy pickup truck back home and to his girlfriend, honey, I'm home. He was caught. He committed suicide in jail. And I covered the case for the Las Vegas Review Journal, but I didn't feel that anybody on the story was really getting to the heart of it, which was, why the hell would this happen? Why would he do something like that? Can we plumb the depths of this guy's personality, his upbringing, his background, and understand what led him to do something like that? And at the same time, I hope, understand and celebrate the all too short life of the girl who's young woman whose life he took. So that's my next project. I'm very deep into it. It's fascinating, and it's led me to some really interesting places and people.
Oh, I'd imagine. You know, it's always such a fun project doing true crime. I mean, how do you deal with all that yourself? I mean, myself, I think I've had 30 books published now that are in that true crime sort of area. Some of them are harder than others. So yourself, how do you deal with it? Because it's not like fiction where you get to, there's not a lot of happy ending, and there isn't a lot of justice, as they say, in true crime. So how is it that you handle this?
Well, again, in this project, I have a lot of support from the people who surround the case, including her family. And that's important to me. I think especially in a case of a young girl like this, I wouldn't, with the kind of horrific facts that surround it, I wouldn't get into it if the family said, Doug, please just let it go. But that's not what they've told me. They want to understand more. They want to get the whole context of it. They want to know the truth. And so I've told them I'm going to go down follow every angle and chase every lead and really try to plumb the depths of what went on in this guy's head and how this came together. And that's what I'm doing. How do I handle it? Some of the things that you see and hear about in an investigation like this are difficult to handle. Photographs or autopsy descriptions, whatever it might be. I'm fortunate, I think, because I've been around long enough, seen enough, and have enough good in my life, enough of a foundation that I can put those kinds of things in context. But do they trouble me sometimes? Of course. Do I sometimes wake up and think about those things, or maybe, you know, see my own daughter and hug her a little bit harder because I think about Naomi? Yeah, very much. And anybody who is a relatively sensitive feeling kind of person who really wants to understand things and gets into this and talks to victims and sees the photos and the documents is going to be affected by it. That's the price you pay for being a writer, and I'm happy to pay that price.
We can always go to the Mojave Desert and soak in the water for a while.
Or have a drink or two.
Yeah, that's our drink of 10. Yeah. Or drink of 10 there, you know.
Yes, like,
so listen, how do people find you? You have a website, you have like a social media output, like where do people find?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So yes, all of the above. My my website is simply Doug Carey, Doug Carey. It's a Finnish name for those who are curious about that kind of thing. My father's parents immigrated from Finland, so Carey spelled a bit like a first name for some people, for women, Kari. So DougCarey.com. On Facebook, Doug Carey Author. On Instagram, at Doug Carey Author. And then if you Google me, you'll see things that I've written. You'll see lots of venues for buying the book. I think Roman and Littlefield, the publisher, may still be offering a pre-publication or some kind of a discount. But it's at Barnes & Noble and Amazon and the usual suspects. Yeah, so it's readily available. I would love for people to read it, and I'd love to hear feedback. I want to get better at what I do. This is the first one, and although I put my heart and soul into it, I want to continue to grow as a writer and as a person, and I'm hopeful that I'll have even better work that lies ahead.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. It just gets better each time you go, you know. So not to worry. Well, we'll have all that up on our website as well, so people can find you and one click. They don't have much trouble finding it. So appreciate you being on the show and talking about your book and what's going on with you.
Well, it's an honor to be on your show, and I really appreciate it and appreciate your interest. Thank you.
Fantastic. Now, the book, of course, is called The Berman Murders, Unraveling the Mojave Desert's Most Mysterious Unsolved Crime. And our guest is the author of that book, Doug Carey. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Helen. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Doug.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.